This episode is brought to you by Rev1. Rev1's mission is to help entrepreneurs build great companies. As you navigate the waters of business entrepreneurship, you don't have to go it alone. A strategic partnership with Rev1 connects innovators to the talent, customers, space, and funding you need when you need it. Get started with Rev1 Startup Studio by visiting rev1ventures.com to learn more. Again, the website is rev1ventures.com. .com 614 Startups Nation, welcome to another episode of the 614 Startups Podcast. My name is Elio Harmon, your host, and I'm back in my favorite seat. And man, listen, this is a long time coming, man. I've been trying to get this brother on the podcast, probably mostly my fault. But I want to introduce the world. If you don't know him already, get ready. This is a good friend of mine, my man, Demetrius Robinson of KJK. Demetrius, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Elio.
Yeah, man. I'm glad that you agreed to come on this podcast. I think I've had many conversations with founders, a few conversations with investors, but I haven't had very many people with kind of that legal pedigree like you do to talk to our founders who listen to the show about how they need to think about the legal side of their business. So welcome to the show. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, you know, I definitely not all your fault. I think we've been trying to figure out how to put this together for a while. And, you know, I'm glad that we finally got to, you know, add it to our calendars where we both were able to sit down. And I've been looking forward to this, you know, for a while. So I'm hopeful that this is going to be the best episode you've ever produced.
Listen, man, I have no doubt it is going to be. So let's just kick it off with you and just set the tone for how good it's going to be by getting to know you a little bit. So I love to start the show with a bit about the guest's personal background and then how they came to live in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah, so great sort of first question. Definitely not originally from Ohio, was not originally an Ohio State fan. I call myself now an Ohio State fan by marriage. You know, my wife went to Ohio State, so I'm fully grown and ingrown into what the Ohio State family is. But I actually grew up, born in Virginia, and grew up there for most of my childhood. Spent my early part of childhood and teen years in Virginia, and then moved to Ohio for school. Never intending to stay, I always thought I'd actually transition to, like, you know, some big city, Chicago, LA or something like that. And that's where my life would be. But, you know, I had a kid at a young age. I joined the Army and then got married and had more kids, and sort of the rest is history. What I found, I think, since I've been in Columbus specifically, is it has that sort of big city feel, without, you know, the heavy traffic, without the cost, you know, all the, I think, prices, especially in the housing market, is pretty high right now, if you've noticed. But yeah, I mean, has everything you want in a big city without, you know, all the associated issues sometimes you experience in those big cities.
Yeah, man. And, you know, I'm going to say Ohio, Virginia. Ohio is up 2-0. My wife is from Virginia, Dale City area, and I got her to move to Ohio. So I got to meet your wife, man. We're running it up. We're running up the score right now. Ohio over Virginia 2-0. In the comments, if you're running up the score, moving other folks from other cities to Columbus, Ohio, go ahead and throw that in the comments. All right. So I always am curious about people's paths to the career or the positions that they have within their company. At what point in your life did you know you wanted to study law and become an attorney? And then as you worked through your law career, why did you decide to focus on startups?
Yeah, really good question, Elio. I think the standing joke within my family is I went to law school so I could beat my brother. He's a doctor out in Texas. And so I got my law degree before his. So really, I win in that regard. But honestly, you know, I think the turning point for me to transition into the law profession is I had to hire a lawyer at a difficult time in my life. When I was young, had a kid at a pretty young age, and had to, you know, use an attorney to try and navigate through that. And that the experience with that attorney at the time was sort of not what I expect from myself when I'm working with clients. it was sort of that eye-opening moment of like, I think I can do it better, but I need to be a lawyer to do that. So, you know, I went to law school and now I do that just in a totally different space, sort of helping, you know, founders navigate through, you know, legal complexities. But I think that was sort of the moment in time where I was like, okay, this is something I got to do for me and my family and pursue forward. I think you asked the second question is like, why do I specialize in enjoy working with startups? And so my career has taken a kind of interesting path. I started my legal career working with the Big Four accounting firm, Ernst & Young, as a tax attorney. While I was there, a mentor of mine sort of advised me that if I wanted to be an accounting attorney, as they're called per se, you know, I could stay with a Big Four, but if I wanted to actually be a, you know, what he thought of as a real attorney, you know, I'd have to transition out. So, you know, an opportunity presented itself that allowed me to start my own firm pretty early in my legal career. And that really kind of sparked my passion of working with builders. And I use the term builders and not founders because I think there's a slight difference. And I think builders actually describes a startup better than just pure founding. And one of the things I equate that to is I like working with my hands. Obviously, you know, most attorneys were in books all the time, we're reading, we're writing, but some ways for me to sort of collect my thoughts is working with my hands. So I've gutted bathrooms, I've rebuilt them, I've built, you know, shelving units and everything in between, because I like the idea of tearing something down, building it up, and going through the process of taking an idea from beginning all the way to the end, and making it bigger, better, badder, whatever you want to call it. And I think I got those skills and those ideas from watching my dad at a young age as a welder and handyman, who was not very educated. I think he did maybe a year of college and then dropped out and you know, made sure that he had the resources to take care of a family. But I think that's where it's kind of sparked that bug of, you know, being a small business owner and seeing my dad do it. And now I have the privilege of like working with builders, you know, and then again, I equate builders to founders because that's what they're doing. They're taking this idea that they've sometimes created in the shower or talking to a buddy or whatever, and they're trying to create something out of sometimes from scratch and get it to this vision of where they think it can be.
Yeah, man. 614 Startups was definitely created in a shower, man. And where we're trying to make this thing into a business. But I agree with you. The idea of a founder is pretty popular. But this reframing it as a builder, it makes you step back a little bit because it's easy to found. It's hard to build, right? And the people who have the grit and the stick-to-itiveness and the willingness to do things the right way, which is why I wanted to talk about the legal aspects when it comes to deciding to build something. The way I found out about KJK, because the firm is originally out of Cleveland, was because Stephanie Pillai was in business development with your firm, and I met with Stephanie, and then she introduced me to Kelsey, and that's how I learned about KJK and the fact that you were opening a Columbus office and you were building this thing, you being builders as well, the GC Advantage program. So what is the GC Advantage program and how similar is launching a new law office to building a company?
Yeah, so I mean, KJK overall, and I'll talk about that first before we talk about GC Advantage per se. I think we've been around for over 100 years or so. Founded by, you know, a couple guys who were like, hey, I think we can do this law thing better. And they have for a very long time. And now we, as the next generation of KJK, are trying to drive that forward. And I think that's where GC Advantage comes in. And, you know, honestly, I get pretty excited talking about GC Advantage, you know, obviously on this podcast, but then when talking to potential clients, to existing clients, to other people, because, you know, the practice of law has been around for generations. I mean, I think, you know, Abraham Lincoln was a lawyer. And he probably, when he practiced law, probably billed by the hour, you know, way back then. I have no knowledge of that. So definitely don't, you know, file a lawsuit or anything like that telling me that I'm misquoting the great Abraham Lincoln. But we've been doing it for so long, and we've been doing it the exact same way, and we're trying to get the exact same results. You know, but in talking to, you know, business owners, you know, what I've found is that the model of an attorney's hourly rate multiplied by the number of hours they work, it's a bit antiquated, and it doesn't necessarily ensure that both parties are incentivized to get the maximum efficiencies in work. Now, does the billable rate model work? It definitely does. And there are reasons that you want to use a billable rate model other than just purely, you know, tradition. Someone has to do with risk management. There's other reasons you want to continue to use a billable rate model. But I think there's opportunities, and that's what GC Advantage is. And so GC Advantage is a comprehensive legal program, but it sets the billable rate at just a flat monthly fee. So clients who are participating in the GC Advantage program aren't getting a bill per hour. They're just getting a set monthly fee. And what we do up front is we look at scoping what that work looks like. So what are the expectations of the client? What are our expectations as well? What are your legal needs throughout a life cycle? And that includes usually like general corporate work, labor employment, real estate, transactional work, and sometimes everything in between. But once we've identified what that scope is, then we just set an hourly rate. Yeah. Or instead of setting our hourly rate, we just establish us a flat monthly fee, and clients use us as much or as little as they want. But what we found is that because they're using the GC Advantage program, they're actually communicating with us more frequently. We're solving problems more often before they become bigger problems, and the cost of trying to solve those problems get much higher, right? So if I can talk to you about this potential employee matter that may turn into litigation if we don't address it beforehand, then I can save you a significant amount of money on your litigation fees, because those are going to make those, it's just the nature of what litigation is. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's really why I'm pretty excited about it, because it allows sort of both parties to feel like their needs are met. And then I think your other question was, you know, how is, you know, starting a program like GC Advantage when something like this doesn't really exist in the marketplace, you know, similar to starting a business or being a founder or builder? And the answer is it's exactly the same. We are just builders, founders, entrepreneurs within an organization, but we have to do market research to determine, you know, is there a market need for the services that we're trying to provide? We have to have discussions with potential customers or consumers to say, is this even something you would buy if it was available in the market? And then we have to understand pricing, right? Because everyone wants to get paid, right, at the end of the day. And so if we're underpricing it, are we impacting our bottom line? If we're overpricing it, are we potentially limiting the number of people or consumers that can participate in the marketplace? And that's not the intent, right? And so, yeah, I mean, there's definitely times that we're throwing shit against the wall to see if it sticks. And if it sticks, yep, we know that's good shit. If it doesn't stick, then we know, hey, we got to go back to the drawing board.
Yeah, that's entrepreneurship 101, right? See what sticks. But, you know, as I'm thinking about a GC Advantage program and you mentioning that it's a monthly thing, I think a lot of people who are building a startup for the first time might be scratching their heads like, wait, isn't legal just a one-time thing that I do when I need to set up my business entity? Like, what is the likelihood that I might need legal advice on a monthly basis? Dispel that myth, kind of the one and done when it comes to legal for startups. And then, oh, maybe I will contact you when I go to pitch VCs and they throw a term sheet in my face. Why do founders need to be thinking about legal as a partner in the journey to building their startups?
Yeah, I think that using the word partner is actually the right term, right? Because, you know, you could go to LegalZoom and they can put together an operating agreement for you. I won't talk about whether or not it's a good operating agreement or not a good operating agreement, but you could get those services, you know, pretty cheaply, right, from another vendor. But what you're not going to get is being able to equate the problems that you're experiencing within your organization, meaning the facts, that's what we look at, to solutions to those problems, right? And I think we'll talk about potentially later about sort of what our roles is, but at the end of the day, our job is kind of to provide information to you as a founder, as a builder, as an entrepreneur, so that you can make better decisions for your business or your journey. And so if you have a partner along that journey with you, it's much easier, one, to have established a relationship so that when things are going rough or not going so well, it's an easier communication. For example, let's say you just use an attorney one time. You're like, hey, just give me my operating agreement and then go away. And then a problem arises. And then you got to hire either that exact same attorney or another attorney. And now you have all these new relationships that you're trying to build. Well, let's say in that relationship, you get to a point where you're like, you kind of really need an attorney, but you can't really afford an attorney because one, you know, you're cash strapped that month or something like that. Well, it's probably better to have established relationship with someone, anyone, who's like, hey, dude, I understand where you're at. I'm definitely able to be flexible. You know, I'm sure that we can make something work. But if you have no relationship, that's probably going to be a harder ask to go to someone and say, hey, can you represent me? But I'm not going to pay you. Or I don't know when I'm going to pay you. That's a difficult ask. So that's also something to think about, for founders when you're thinking about, building your partnerships. And it doesn't necessarily just have to be in the legal space. It can be in other spaces as well. But those are the reasons you get partnerships, is you have resources available to you to help you along your journey so that you're getting to the path that you're looking to achieve.
Yeah, and I'm not going to make this all about me. Listen, I've made so many mistakes when it comes to building a business, whether it be on the legal side, the accounting side, et cetera. There's no need to learn these lessons the hard way, which is why we're having these podcasts. And so if you're out there and you're like me, one of the things that I'm looking forward to formalizing is a lot of these relationships and really bringing on board partners that are going to guide me. But we're going to get into the nitty gritty of some of the things that you need to be thinking about as a founder as you build your business. And we're going to be tapping into Demetrius' expertise after we get back from these breaks. We need to hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back after these messages.
Support for the 614 Startups podcast comes from Nationwide. Nationwide's mission is to protect people, businesses, and futures with extraordinary care. To help fulfill that mission, Nationwide is looking to invest its $350 million venture capital investment fund in InsurTechs that will help them create new and exciting products and solutions to meet the needs of their customers. If you're interested in partnering with Nationwide's venture capital team, visit nationwideventures.com to learn more. Again, the website is nationwideventures.com. Nationwide is on your side. Today's episode is sponsored by the City of Dublin's Division of Economic Development. The City of Dublin provides world-class tailored business services and resources to ensure the best possible environment for businesses to recruit talent and thrive. Because of this strategic focus and commitment to employer growth, Dublin is the only accredited economic development organization in the state of Ohio. The City of Dublin supports startups and entrepreneurs by offering targeted resources and training programs to grow companies that are financially sustainable, innovative, and committed to creating jobs. Learn how other businesses depend on Dublin. Visit thriveindublinohio.com.
614 Startups Nation, thank you so much for hanging in there with us, man. We're about to get into the nitty gritty of startup law and all things legal, as much as we can cover within the time span of a podcast. But I want to start with the role of a startup attorney. We've touched on that a little bit when you say a partner. But, you're a married guy. I'm married. A partner in that context is one thing, right? So, for
sometimes.
All that entails. Sometimes, yeah. So let's set the right framework for what a client-attorney partnership in a startup should look like.
Yeah, great question. And I say sometimes because, sometimes it does feel... Attorneys on occasion take on a lot of their clients' emotions, which as, husbands, at times we do the same, right? Our wives, our kids, are going through difficult situations and we take that personal. And that's good on times. And sometimes that as attorneys, we got to be careful, to make sure that we're balancing our own mental health as well with those things. But we take it personal because then if we're taking it personal, it means it matters. And that means we're going to put additional effort into making sure that the advice that we're giving, the information we're providing, the services we're providing are meeting the needs of the individuals we're working with. But I think honestly, the most important role of an attorney, and especially an attorney that works with startups, is actually listening. And I think too often attorneys, we tout our fancy degrees. We tell people, what they want to hear. And we tell them, hey, you have to do this. But in reality, my job is to give you the best, most accurate information so that you as a business owner can make the best decision for your business. And sometimes that means telling you the hard truth of like, hey, here's the consequences of your actions. But that doesn't mean telling you what to do. It just says, it means saying, hey, if you choose to take this path, here's the things you may, here's your options, here's the principal consequences, here's the potential rewards, and then you choose. And you, at the end of the day, you get to choose what's the right path or the wrong path. I have no say in that, and neither do I have any potential, you know, benefit if you choose one way or another, right? Because at the end of the day, you're still going to pay my bill, right? So you can't think about it that way. And so our job is to make sure that you have, you know, the best information so you can make the best decision for your business. I think the other part of it, you know, as it relates to listening is sometimes being a founder, being a builder is a pretty lonely journey. You know, there are times, you know, I remember when I started my own practice that, you know, I love my wife and, you know, I love my kids, but sometimes you don't want to talk through all the details of the struggles that you're going through because you don't want to burden them with those struggles. And it's you trying to shield them from sometimes reality, sometimes just the things that are going on your head. So sometimes as an attorney, you know, my law license from the Ohio Supreme Court says attorney and counselor at law. And I never really understood, you know, what counselor at law meant until I started working with founders and builders and understood that sometimes I'm just a listening ear. And I'm not actually giving legal advice. Sometimes I'm just giving practical advice. And I'm talking about, you know, my perspectives, my background, and I'm giving them information, hopefully, that tells them that, like, you're not alone. There's people that have done exactly what you're trying to do before. They may have done it in a different way. They may have done it something in a different industry. But there's people that have come across the situations that you're probably experiencing that have gotten through it and gotten to the other side.
Yeah, and entrepreneurship is indeed lonely. And you could be lonely in a crowd because unless you sincerely trust somebody, a lot of times it's very hard to open up about the struggles of entrepreneurship. But over time, I could see a legal professional being somebody that you could turn to and really be able to talk to and get advice because you guys are not only managing a relationship, for example, between you and I, you're also seeing other founders who've gone through it. And like you said, you can draw from their experiences as well. One of the things when you think lawyers for the longest time is billable hour or how much it's going to cost. And we're human. Anytime you're getting ready to make a purchase, you're trying to do some kind of cost benefit analysis to figure out what's the true value here. It's $450 an hour, really the real value here. But we don't really know because the only thing that lawyers are helping us to avoid is lawsuits. And if you've never been sued before, and we see these kind of crazy judgments out there when somebody does lose a lawsuit, but how can founders think about prevention? It's just like your health. You know you need to eat and exercise. It doesn't become valuable until you're sick. How do you help founders quantify the value of legal advice without the prospect of being sued being right in their face?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. And I think it's actually a question that most startups, founders, business owners think about pretty frequently. Because it's like, well, I only have a limited resource, right? A budget, money. And how do I make sure that I'm allocating it appropriately? And I would say that legal services is an investment. There's no sort of ifs, ands, and buts about that. But you use that investment not just because you're trying to avoid litigation, while litigation can be very expensive, right? It's the same thing as buying insurance, right? So I buy car insurance because if my car gets totaled, do I want to fork over $25,000 to buy a new car or $45,000 right now? I mean, with rate, the way the rates are going, buy a new vehicle, right? No, I pay, you know, $100 a month to my insurance company. And then if something happens, you know, that they buy a new car for me, right? So you got to think about it from that perspective as too. Is legal services, sometimes it's your insurance against liability. The other part is the fun part about being a founder, builder, entrepreneur is the thing I like is the creativity that the law allows me to provide, right? So, but it can't do that if I'm not having a conversation with you about the situation that's arising, right? So whether it's a service contract between two parties, whether it's a partnership agreement between two founders, there's creativity that can be embedded into those agreements that allow both parties to feel like they're winning. And so those are the sort of intangible aspects, I think, of working with a lawyer that the pure billable hour does not sort of equate to. And when you think about the billable hour, you're actually not paying for the form or the document or whatever I'm giving you, you're actually paying for the expertise that I'm providing to you to help you make that good, better decision. That is valuable. It's valuable. Some say because the person went to law school. Some say it's valuable because the logical skills that attorneys gather. You know, I think there's many ways that you can equate that billable hour rate to a certain level of value. But at the end of the day, it comes down to it's an insurance policy.
All right. It makes sense. I mean, it's an insurance policy about as good as insurance you can buy against all of the things that could possibly happen when you're building a company. But let's start with Startup Legal 101, the name, choosing a name for a startup. Many people are trying to choose the most interesting name for their startup, but what are some of the legal considerations and implications when a founder is thinking about what they're going to call their startup?
Yeah, so I probably would focus first on not the legal considerations, but actually on the branding consideration. And the reason I think we want to start that way is because that is then going to equate to what the legal ramifications are. And so the branding considerations you got to think about when you're choosing a name is, what do I want the world to know me by, right? And I equate that to like celebrities, right? So I think when you look at most celebrities, and I won't name any because I'm not getting any money from them, is like the name that their parents gave them at birth is not the name that they, you know, we equate with them now, but that's their brand and that's what they're selling and that's how we know them. And so that's why we're buying, you know, whatever they're selling. But that's you. That's you. That's your name is your brand. It's your, it's usually based on some sort of theme or your mission statement, but it's what you're telling the world you plan to be or who you plan to represent. And so I think that's really where you got to focus first is who do I want to be, who I want to represent, and then who do I want the world to see me as? But, you know, as you think about developing that name brand and then protecting it, you know, you got to think about, does someone else already have it? Because someone else already has it, they may come after you for trying to use, you know, the goodwill that they've created with that name brand. But, you know, in the very beginning, when you're a startup, you probably don't have any money or brand recognition, right? So, you know, when you think about what's the cost of me trying to protect something that's not worth anything, I tell clients pretty often, don't do anything, right? If it's not worth anything, and don't protect it, because you only protect something that's worth something. Again, going back to the insurance consideration, right? But there's going to be a point in time, hopefully in your entrepreneur journey, that your brand is going to be worth something. And so you're going to want to take steps to protect that brand. And the moment that you got to think about when that happens is, what is the value of me doing something or not doing anything? And if I do something, right, am I going to lose? Or if I do nothing, am I going to gain something? So what's that really mean? And it really means if someone comes down the line and tries to steal my brand or starts trying to operate under my brand, is the event of that happening going to cost me money or lost opportunity? If that's going to happen, yeah, you want to take steps to protect it so that you don't lose money or lose opportunity to make money. And then when you think about like something to gain, you think about if I'm going to be acquired or if someone's offering to give me an influx of cash, if my brand is not protected, will they not do what they're thinking about doing? And so those are the moments in time when you kind of really want to start thinking about protecting your brand. If you're just like, you know, I wake up in the morning, I took a shower and I'm like, oh, I'm going to start this brand new company. You know, I'd probably, you know, think pretty hard about whether or not I need to pay financial resources to protect something that doesn't have any value yet.
Yeah, man. And this became really real lately. So speaking of when you first start out, whether or not you want to protect something, if it has value or not. When I first started out, 614 startups is like area code plus word startups, 614 startups, right? That was about as much thought as I put into it. And then this year, you send me an email and you're like, do you see this? Right. And there was another group that was doing an event that used a lot of the brand signatures or felt very much like it could be a 614 startups event, but it wasn't. And let me tell you the ripple of that. From the time you sent me that email, there are two very important things that clued me into how valuable the 614 startups brand is becoming. Somebody from a large, like Fortune 10 company calls me up like, yo, I see you have an event coming up. I want to sponsor. What they saw was this other event But because they knew the value that my company brought, they were so excited that they thought this event was mine that they just wanted to sponsor it. Right. So literally, because that was just one example, and it was a good number, Demetrius. It was a good number. Okay. And then there's a council member Nick Bankston. I run into him at the same event that we were at. I think it was the U event over at Waves.
Yeah.
And council member Bankston was like, "Yo, how are you going to do an event and not tell me?" I'm like, "Listen, this cannot continue to happen." Right. That brand proximity is causing confusion in the marketplace, so much so a lot of people who want to support my brand are confusing my brand with somebody else's brand. Whether that person's doing it intentionally or not is not the point.
Yeah.
The point is your email is probably, those three people just happen to be the people who told me. There are probably a whole bunch of people who haven't contacted me who are having the same thought. And that's what I think we're talking about when it comes to protecting your brand. In my case, it really had financial implications with not having that brand protection. But I want to pivot away from just the startup names to kind of legal entities now. And the buzziest of all buzzy things in business, the LLC. Super popular. You can't go on Instagram without people telling you you need an LLC yesterday. But what are the pros and cons of LLCs, and how should startups think about choosing a legal entity?
Yeah, so I mean, LLCs actually haven't been around for that long. And, you know, I they're kind of a new phenomenon over the last probably couple decades or so. And while that may seem like a long time, in legal space, that's not a very long time. And so, you know, they are what's you know, LLC, limited liability company, and they're used pretty frequently because they're easy to set up. They're usually pretty easy to maintain, and there's not a lot of, you know, things you can do to, you know, screw things up as it relates to LLCs. And so I think that's why they're probably used, you know, pretty frequently. For example, you know, in the state of Ohio, you can set up an LLC, you know, the Secretary of State will take it for $99, right? So, you know, the entry level cost to getting something like an LLC done is easy. You know, most, you know, some attorneys will tell you that the entity selection is the most important part of forming a business and getting the right entity, you know, created. And I would probably disagree because, one, there's opportunities in the future to change what kind of entity, because the vision that you may have right now may not be the vision that your company ends up being. And there's opportunities to change what the entity looks like, whether it's, you know, creating another entity and then merging them into each other, or, you know, creating another entity and putting it underneath. I mean, there's all these options that you could use to change who you are from an entity perspective, even if you're not changing your brand. But usually when I talk to startups about, you know, what entity they should use, one, I tell them not to be sole proprietors, right? So a sole proprietorship is, you know, Demetrius goes out and I start a business and I just start doing business as, you know, Demetrius Robinson. While there's opportunities to do that, you know, if my kid starts a lemonade stand, you know, we may just put it under, you know, his name and he can sell lemonade on the streets. But in reality, you want a certain level of protection between you and the outside world. And that's usually what our entity does, is it creates that level of protection between you and whoever may come after you, whether it's from a liability perspective or the tax man. But as a tax attorney, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about taxes. I'd probably get, you know, isolated from the tax community. And so that's usually a lot of the conversation we're having with entity selection is how do you want to be taxed? I mean, LLCs actually are some of the most flexible as it relates to taxation. If it's just one of you, if your tax says as if you were a sole proprietorship, but you still have that level of protection from liability. If you're an LLC and you have more than one person, you're traditionally taxed as a partnership unless you elect out of that. And you can elect out of it to be either a C corp or S corp. And that just means, you know, you're taxed a little differently than you would be otherwise, but you still get the same level of protections. And so those are things, something to think about when you're thinking about entity selection. The other is formality, right? So you want to be more formal in your operations, meaning do you want to make sure you have the proper documentation? Do you want meeting minutes? Do you want to have a board of directors? You know, all these sort of things that create another layer of formality that if you don't do those, then the government or a third party can do what's called piercing the corporate veil. And basically what that means is the government looks at your entity as kind of made up and just goes, you know, directly to you at the source. But if you've formalized, if you've taken all the right steps to ensure that your company is doing all the right things and documenting things appropriately, then you usually prevent that personal liability that an LLC or another sort of entity is designed to allow for. And then from a tax perspective, again, you know, using certain types of entities allows you to some financial freedoms on the tax side. If you're a corporation, usually you're double taxed because you're taxed at the corporation. And then when you distribute income to the shareholders, you're sort of taxed again. But when you're an LLC or you've elected an S-corp status or you're a sole proprietor situation, then it just goes directly to your tax return that you file every year. There's just a separate form that you use to allocate that income to your personal return.
Yeah, great information. And you would be remiss. I know the tax community would come after you because you're still officially on Instagram Biz Tax Attorney. All right. So that's part of your brand. We always got to talk taxes no matter what. Now, in the world of just entity formation, Delaware is legendary. There's this thing in the startup community like, yeah, if you ever want to raise money, you need a Delaware entity. True or false? And why do so many people turn to Delaware to register their startups?
Yeah, I would say the answer is false. And, you know, I think the reason it's false is Delaware has a reputation of their judges being very good at being able to interpret business-related disputes and solve those disputes because they deal with it on a pretty frequent basis. Versus if you're in another jurisdiction, that may not be the case because, you know, a Franklin County judge, for example, here in Ohio, just may not deal with business-related issues on such a frequent basis that if a issue related to whatever you're trying to deal with comes forward to them, they may not have the same level of expertise that a Delaware judge does. So that's why some people file in Delaware. But I say false because not everyone needs that level of security as it relates to their business. There are definitely significant reasons why. And if an investor is planning to write a big check to you and they're like, you must be a Delaware company, I'll tell you, go ahead and file the documents and be a Delaware company, right? Because there's financial benefits to that. But there's also some downfalls to being a Delaware company. And that is because Delaware is such a good state to file in, they charge, you know, an exorbitant amount of money sometimes as what they call franchise tax for companies that do business in Delaware. So, you know, you got to think about weighing those pros and cons as you're trying to navigate. And I've filed both. I filed companies to be Delaware related entities, and I filed Ohio. Some companies use Nevada. That's another jurisdiction that's pretty up and coming. As it relates to, you know, Delaware-ish like expertise. Other states, including Texas, just passed the law to create a separate business court to try to create that expertise going forward. But, you know, it's a pro and con, just like every other business decision you got to make. Is the juice worth the squeeze? And if the answer is yes, then file and deal with the repercussions of having to file annual returns and certain things like that. But if it's not, then, you know, look at the jurisdiction that I'm currently in. Does it meet my requirements? If it meets my requirements, then, you know, go where it makes sense.
Yeah, maybe a point of quantifying legal advice. There's a real cost there between choosing a jurisdiction like Ohio to register your business and just by default choosing to register in Delaware. There's going to be additional complexity and additional costs, which is why legal advice is an investment. All right, Demetrius, we're going to take a quick break. 614 Startups Nation, are you feeling smarter? Okay. Are you feeling Demetrius level legal prowess right now and ready to go out there and at least have the base information to make a few decisions? And hopefully the right decision would be to pick up the phone and call an expert. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after these messages.
This episode is brought to you by KJK. Tired of the billable hour? KJK has a solution. The KJK GC Advantage program offers businesses comprehensive legal services in the areas of employment, corporate services, real estate, trademark, intellectual property, and estate planning, all for a set monthly fee. KJK serves as their clients' partners in business, not just their lawyers. Along with cost certainty and predictability, the KJK GC Advantage program gives clients peace of mind, knowing their projects will be handled quickly and efficiently, maximizing the return on investment on their legal spend. So don't go it alone. Let KJK help. Learn more by visiting kjk.com.
614 Startups Nation, welcome back. I'm continuing my conversation with Demetrius Robinson of KJK. Just opened an office, not just, but they have a new office here in Columbus, Ohio, where they run the GC Advantage program. It's a program designed specifically for startups where they are eliminating the billable hour. All right, Demetrius, we're going to get right into this thing. The history of startups is rife with co-founder horror stories. How should founders think about structuring their relationship when they're coming together to start a business? How should they structure that legally?
I think that's a really good question. And a question sometimes I get later in the relationship when, you know, I wish I'd gotten it before the relationship started, or at least in the beginning, right? When they're, you know, when we think about dating sometimes, right? And I think that's actually, using the term dating is a great reference to what a business relationship for a founder or co-founder is. Because it is like you're dating, and then you get married when you sign that partnership agreement, or that shareholder agreement. Because you're two parties that are trying to navigate a very difficult situation, and you have an idea about what it's supposed to be, and sometimes that's in sync at some point in time, and sometimes it gets out of sync. And so you're trying to figure out how best in the very beginning of the relationship to make sure that you can solve those problems as it goes on later on. You know, I think a good outline of that is sort of a horror story that I experienced as counsel to a startup where, you know, in the very beginning of the relationship, there was three founders. They had a great idea of what they thought this organization could be. And so they all jump in and try to build this business. And eventually, you know, the driving founder, I'll call him, was kind of pulling everyone along, and the other three individuals weren't really contributing significantly to the development and growth of the business. And so, you know, he came to me and, how do I figure out how to navigate this? You know, I'd really like to just, you know, get rid of them or buy them out. And, you know, we struggled through because while the company wasn't worth a lot in the very beginning, you know, there was a potential that down the road it might be. And so everyone was kind of hoping for that opportunity, but they weren't contributing to the success now. So they were really just riding someone's coattails. And so eventually we were able to buy some out and then squeeze some other ones, you know, out using, you know, some legal maneuvers. But it tells you the importance of getting it right in the beginning, because they did not appropriately articulate how their relationship was supposed to be in the beginning. And it was more difficult and more expensive, obviously, from a legal perspective to do that later on. So you asked, you know, what do you think about, right? How do you structure a relationship? And I'll tell you know, it's just like, you know, when I was dating my wife, of like talking about expectations. And you got to talk about, you know, what's important, what, you know, where are we going, how are we getting there, what's our timeline for getting there, what's the expectations, who's pulling, who's pushing, creating that sort of mutual vision of what you think this is going to be. And you talk about that, and you write all that down. And then hopefully you have an attorney that helps you draft some documents. But you have to understand, like, what's the value that person, each of the founders or co-founders, are bringing to the table? That's another question you should ask yourself. And then, is this person that I'm bringing to the table, are they only going to add value in the beginning? But once we get sort of started and we're driving forward, are they not going to be able to add value either because we outgrew them, or they lack the expertise, or they lack, you know, continued vision to try to drive forward? And if that's the case, you want to be very cautious, because you may give away more of your company than you'd like to for someone who's not going to add value long term. And then the last thing is really, you know, do we have the agreements in place that outlines the conversations that we've had, right? So if this thing goes sour, how do I, you know, remove a partner? How do I deal with a conflict within the relationship? If we want to add more people because we think we need more expertise, or we need additional resources, how do I do that? And you put all those things in a document, you have an attorney look it over, then you sign, and then you execute that vision. That's how you can avoid horror stories, but that's how you mitigate them.
Yeah, I think medicate is the right word. And I think if everybody's a responsible adult, people understand that some of these things need to be codified, right? They need to be down on paper. They need to be written down. You don't, again, none of this stuff you should have to learn the hard way. Allow other people's experiences to inform your decision-making and do it right the first time around. That we could dedicate a whole podcast to any one of these topics that we've discussed, but I want to move on to the one that probably everybody has been waiting for us to get to, which is I want to raise capital, right? Anytime I want to post to get a lot of views, I just put raise capital in it and then people just eat it up, all right? That's what everybody cares about. But what are investors, the people on the other side of the table, looking for when they're doing legal due diligence? I've heard about deals that fell apart because legal due diligence just didn't meet the criteria that the investor was looking for. So what are investors typically looking for there?
Yeah, I think about due diligence as like a used car inspection, right? So you kick the tires, check under the hood, you maybe drive it around the block, make sure nothing falls off. That's due diligence, right? And an investor does that because they're trying to understand what's under the hood, to use that term, and what's going to bite them in the ass potentially down the road, right? So they're giving their money, usually not necessarily their money. A venture capital is really giving someone else's money that they're managing to you, and so they want to make sure that they're taking all the steps to protect the individuals that are giving them money, their interest. And so I think when I hear from founders, a lot of times, you know, the thing that they're afraid of is, well, what if I didn't do something right? Is an investor going to walk away? And the answer is not necessarily but it depends how bad it's broken. So, you know, if you're checking out that used car and, you know, the back window's broken, that's pretty easy to fix that, right? But if I drive the car around the block and the engine falls out, I'm probably not going to spend a lot of money trying to fix a problem like that. And that's exactly how the investor looks at it is, if it's a problem that's pretty easy to fix, then maybe I just adjust the purchase price to accommodate this broken item. Or is that a red flag, right? So if the back window is broken, are all the back seats gone? Or is it just the back window's broken? So that's what your sort of investors are thinking about. To further answer your question, you know, I think the most things that investors are looking at falls into a couple categories. The first is they're looking at your customers and your vendors. Right. So that's how are you making money? And then how is that money being expended to other people? And I think a good example of that is recently in the news. I don't know if you've seen, but, you know, JP Morgan bought a startup who articulated that they had a certain amount of customers. And the more they did some due diligence, they determined like all those customers were fake. And, you know, that they paid a lot of money for a company that may not have had everything that they articulated that they had. Well, that's what investors try to avoid is those sort of situations. So they're asking those questions to make sure that information you're providing is accurate. The next is compliance with regulatory obligations, right? And the reason they're looking at that is because as a potential partner in that business, are they then going to become liable if a governmental agency comes after the company for one reason or another? And they don't want to open themselves to that level of scrutiny. The other is usually ones that are not like, if it's broken, you can fix it, but sort of aren't usually big deals. It's corporate governance. That's not usually a big deal, right? If you didn't take all the minutes you were supposed to take, if your corporate filings maybe not are up to par as where they should be, your cap table's a little off a little bit, but are easily fixable, then those are probably not like red flags. But if you have, you know, potential or existing litigation, that's going to be expensive. If you have employment related issues, meaning like, do you have employment agreements with all the parties that you're working with or independent contractor agreements? Do you have any severance agreements or incentive agreements with your employees or things like that? They want to know that, right? Because they want to know that, you know, if they purchase the company, are they going to have to expend certain funds or what's the risk associated with one employer or another? The other is, and we talked about this earlier in the podcast, is your intellectual property, right? So did you take steps to protect your brand? You know, whether that's a trademark, whether it's a patent, whether it's an agreement between another party, you know, they want to understand that because sometimes that's exactly what they're buying. They're buying you as the founder, and they're buying your intellectual property because that's where the value is. And then last is financials. And I think some founders get hung up on like, why I'm making money? Well, a lot of times, you know, venture capitalists aren't actually buying companies that made money. There's some major brands that are on the, you know, the Dow and the S&P, that have not made money in a very long time since they joined, you know, those platforms. So, you know, I think making money in that sense of like profitability is not always necessarily the end all be all. But is there a pathway forward to making money? I think, especially now, with the collapse of SVB and, you know, some other companies like that, you know, and what I'm hearing from investors is they are looking a little more scrutiny to whether or not there is a pathway to profitability for a company. And it doesn't have to be, you know, overnight, but, you know, is there a pathway 3, 5, you know, 7 years or so that's going to get us, you know, back a return on our investment? Because at the end of the day, that's what it is, right? So a VC says to an investor, hey, if you give me your money, I will get you X return on your investment. And so they have to be stewards of that money. So when they're investing in you, they have to make sure that they're taking the steps to do that.
Yeah, everything goes smoother if you're organized. And that's why it's important to have that legal advisor along with you, right? It's not just a verification of the customers, but it's also a verification of the contracts with those customers, right? Are they structured in a way that is actually it can be enforced in court or whatever the case may be. But if you just went to, I don't want to use a online, you know, they might come around and want to sponsor. Okay. But what I'm saying is you could go anywhere and get these documents, or you could go to a template site and get them. But part of that due diligence probably is also the quality of your contracts that you have with your different vendors and your different customers as well, to make sure that those are solid. All right. So as we were scaling and building this business, we went out, and one of the things that we wanted to find was a legal partner. And we're excited that KJK is a legal partner. Probably somewhere in the break, you heard an ad for KJK. And one of the benefits to being a listener of this show is that you get a free consultation with them. So, Demetrius, how do people engage with you? How do they, you know, reach out to maybe Kelsey or another member of the team to get their consult set up? And then where are you putting out content? Because I see what you've been doing on LinkedIn, man. I'm liking it. So how do people engage with you, KJK, and then how do people engage with your content?
Yeah, great question. And I'll jokingly say, if I get a ton of listeners that ask for free consults, I will charge that back to 614 Startups. No, just totally Josh in there.
Yeah, man, that was not in the agreement. You see what I'm saying? I'm learning. That was not in the agreement.
Well, maybe you need a new legal counsel. No, but just totally kidding there. So, yeah, so great question. You know, I think the best way to reach us is through our social channels. I enjoy engaging on social media, as you can probably see. One, because I think it allows me as a professional to communicate with individuals my knowledge, my skill sets, in ways that I can do for free, right? You don't have to engage me. You can just look at it and see sort of the things that we're thinking about. So definitely check me out on LinkedIn. Check me out on Instagram. Instagram's at Biz Tax Attorney. LinkedIn, just look up Demetrius Robinson, and you'll find me on LinkedIn. The other way to reach me and my team is through kjk.com. There you'll find GC Advantage and the members of the GC Advantage team. And you can reach out to any of those individuals. We're happy to talk to you to learn about, you know, what the struggles you're going through, or just like, hey, maybe I didn't do something that I thought I should do, and now I need some support in fixing that. Or maybe I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. I just need some advice on dealing with that. So yeah, I mean, definitely feel free to reach us there. And don't be a person that sends a LinkedIn invite and then like pitches me on selling something, because I probably will block you afterwards. Like, just like talk to me and say like, hey, that's, I love your content, or I just want to like, you know, explore what this looks like. Because I think that's where in our business, relationships is way more important than engagements, because we're looking for long-term individuals to work with. And we plan to be there from ideation to exit. So those are things that happen overnight. So I choose to interact with people who are thinking about that the same way.
All right. Well, Demetrius, man, certainly I highly recommend you following his content on LinkedIn. He's been pushing out a lot of stuff, and reach out to him. Demetrius is a super cool dude. And so I'm going to give these folks my final word, Demetrius, and then we're going to grab before we both are sleeping on the couch. not getting home in time. So the old school 1980s, early 90s, you know, there was this Hair Club for Men commercial that was out. And the guy's line, I think, was something like, I'm not only the president, I'm also a customer, or something like, or client. I'm not only the president, I'm a client. And it's the same thing here, man. I'm not only, KJK is not only our legal partner from an advertising standpoint, but I'm proud to say that I recently became a client of KJK and my experience has been excellent. And so if you guys are thinking about a legal partner, please do your own due diligence. Nothing said here represents any legal advice. Am I right in saying that, Demetrius?
Yeah, definitely great. Let's say legal and tax advice.
No legal and tax advice here. Do your own due diligence, man. But if you're curious and you want to talk to a genuine person, you know, give you that free consultation and at least answer a few questions, reach out to Demetrius and the team at KJK. All right, folks, that's the podcast. Demetrius, thank you so much for coming on. And for all our listeners, until next time, peace.
That's a wrap, folks. You can find this and all our episodes on our website, 614startups.com. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, and all your favorite podcasting platforms. Don't forget to subscribe and write a review. If you'd like updates sent directly to your inbox, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter on the website. To engage in the 614 Startups community, follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at 614 Startups on all platforms and join the conversation. For sponsorship opportunities and collaborations, email us at info@614startups.com.